Hello, my name is Lisa Falsco. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's such a pleasure to see everyone on this brisk night, or brisk afternoon, I should say. If I could remind you to turn off your cell phones, please. We love your ringtones, but not for our recording on KSKA. They are recording our program, thanks to Will here in the corner. And you'll be able to go to KSKA's website and listen to this program next week and download it via feed anytime you want to hear it or send it to your friends. We today at the front, as well as several wonderful items that our speaker has brought for you to browse for the holiday seasons, and that will be open during our program, and if you have to leave early, you can stop there on the way out. We also have a book. People have asked us to have books of our upcoming speakers available earlier, prior to their program, so we're listening, and we are offering Victor Komras, who is our speaker in the 1st of April, his book, if you want to read ahead of time. It is Flawed Diplomacy, the United Nations, and the War on Terrorism. So we have that at the front desk as well. We are a membership organization, so if you are not a current member, please sign up at the front desk and support the great programs we are providing for our students and the community. At this time, I'd like to recognize any students. There probably are not any with finals week and that wrapping up, but if there are any students, wow, who got away, great. Thank you very much for coming. And thanks so much to BP, who sponsors all of our student lunches. Thank you, BP. Our WorldQuest competition for students will be February 5th at UAA, and that is a competition for high school students who want to test their knowledge on foreign affairs, current events, what's happening around the world, and teams of four participate, and the winning team gets an all-expense-paid trip to Washington, D.C. to participate in the national competition. So if you are a student or know a student, please give us a call or stop by the front desk, and we'll give you information about how to get them involved. Before I introduce the head table, I'd like to ask Kari to come up with our drawing for a bread basket. Thanks to our sponsor, Great Harvest Bread. And Nate, if you'd like to pull the lucky person. Okay, I hope you have a blue ticket. And the number is 583-691. 583-691. Hey.
Could you give it to the food bank?
Yes. Will won our bread basket, and he would like to donate it to the food bank. Thank you. We will do that. That's fantastic. At our head table, we have to my immediate left, Nate York, who will be introduced by our introducer, John Eng, and Marcus Stanfield to his left. And to his immediate left, we have John Eng, one of our past board members. He's also on a committee of ours, very important committee. And I'd like to introduce him and thank him for coming up to introduce our panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, we're in for a treat today. I met Nate York as a result of belonging to the Alaska World Affairs Council, and he dug his way into my heart because of what he says and does. But to give you a little bit of a background, Nate attended and graduated from Alaska Pacific University, so he lived here in Anchorage for quite some time. He left to go to help distribute school supplies, and actually tells me he did that with his brother. And what motivated him to do what he's doing today is he was frustrated by the amount of waste he saw going on with different government and United Nations organizations that do things and are very bureaucratic, but with good intentions, but there's so much waste. So he was going to try to accomplish something that had less waste. I was impressed with this when he spoke to us another time and indicated that he went back to Afghanistan and built a couple schools for literacy programs, which is close to my heart. And those schools are built for the 20,000 to 30,000 each, with local participation compared to a $130,000 school, similar school by the World Bank. So that's what's motivated him, and he enjoys it. Nate is married, his hobbies. He tells me he didn't want to tell me, and finally he uttered out, well, I like to play poker. But promoting literacy programs, he likes to read himself, which I do, and he especially is responding to the needs of the people he encounters, and we look forward to listening to his presentation, and so I thank you if you'll help me give a warm welcome to Nate York.
Thank you. It's great to be back. I think the last time I presented here was probably something like 7 years ago. And at that point, I think I had probably built two girls' schools. And after that, we continued to work in Afghanistan and eventually built seven girls' schools. So I'm just going to start by giving you a little background on myself and how the organization was started, and then kind of give you some examples, some stories of how the way how we work. I had my first experience with humanitarian aid when I was 25 years old, and I got this amazing job in Bosnia. And so I was the logistics guy who had to figure out how to land a ship that was coming from Sweden and land it in Croatia and then distribute 18 containers of aid throughout, 110 containers of aid throughout 18 cities. So I spent 9 months working with the Bosnian government, figuring out where we're going to land this ship, getting shot at. It was a pretty hot area. The ship arrived. It was called Ship to Bosnia, and it was kind of a big thing. There was media going on. It was on Bosnia television, and we distributed the goods. They had come from Sweden and Finland and Amsterdam, and so we transported all these containers out to these 18 different cities, and when they opened up the containers, they were filled with, like, old clothes and unusable medical equipment. And here, you know, I just spent almost a year of my life trying to figure out how to get this stuff into Bosnia while, you know, risking my life. And there was a joke in Bosnia that the project wasn't shipped to Bosnia, it was shit to Bosnia. And so I learned a great lesson, and that was the lesson of we could have provided almost three times as much stuff that was more appropriate, purchased it locally, and help the local economies rather than guessing what people need and shipping it from far away at huge costs. And so from there, I was a little shell-shocked, and so I moved to Alaska and did a bunch of different things up here. Eventually said, look, I got to get my degree, so I went to APU. 9/11 happened, and my mom let me know about my cousin's organization that was in Uzbekistan that was sending a team into northern Afghanistan. And so I was part of I joined them as part of a three-person team. And we went from Uzbekistan into the province of Xiaozhan over to Shevargon. And so we set up an office there. And I began to take a look at the different schools in the area. And the first school that we went and toured, it was a girls' school that had been closed for 4 years. The Taliban had torched all the desks and chairs. They had broken out all the windows. There was no heat in the classrooms. And so I went to the local market and started sourcing out how much it would cost to get the school back up and running. And I found that we could buy heaters for each classroom for $10 a piece. And I found that we could fix all the windows in 15 classrooms for like $258. And I spoke with the parents of these girls, and the dads came and helped fix the roof, which was leaking in a mess, for $300. And so I was like, wow, you know, I was excited. We could do a lot with very little money. And so I connected the organization I was with UNICEF, which at that time UNICEF was doing a program called Back to School. And so their intention was to deliver school supplies throughout every village and city in Afghanistan. And so our organization was given the task to distribute school supplies throughout the province of Xiaozhan. So that's like a state. There's 25 provinces, and we were responsible for one. So UNICEF comes, and they drop off there. They had 17 lorries of school supplies that we were to distribute. And we started looking at some of this stuff, and there were in these beautiful like boxes, and they had been flown in C-130s from Copenhagen. And so we start going to schools and trying to distribute them, and we're noticing that while they're super high quality, you know, Northern European school supplies, when you opened up the box, which was for 40 kids, there was 80 notebooks. Okay, so that divides into 40, so that's cool. Each kid gets two notebooks. There were 40 pencils, so each of the kids gets a pencil. But then there was like 8 sets of crayons and 2 sets of compasses, and you know, there was 12 pens, and nothing could be evenly distributed. So we ended up having to leave those boxes with the headmaster or whatever. And the kids got 2 notebooks, 1 pencil, and a plastic bag. So I just looked on the UNICEF website, and the cost of one of those boxes for 40 kids is $256 if you want to go purchase one of those. What we started finding out is actually as we started to build our girls' schools, and we didn't rely on getting school supplies from the outside, we just went to the market and we started sourcing what backpacks would cost, and we bought these backpacks, that's Ayub and I, in Afghan Tepa village. We bought those backpacks for $1. And we were able to get 10 notebooks and 10 pencils for each kid for $1. And we were able to just buy, probably when you look at the cost of the C-130 and everything and purchasing local, we were probably able to get about 20 times the amount of school supplies for the same amount of money. So that was a real lesson that I had taken from Bosnia and was able to use in Afghanistan. So I just want to go into another principle that we use in how we determine projects. Starting small is really key. And so I'm going to give you an example of a project we started in Malawi. At near Malawi Children's Village, we started a fish farm. And actually, there's a person here that helped fund that. Thank you, Eric. and so we had this barren piece of land, and for $15,000 we were able to dig the fish ponds, $10,000 rehab that house. So it was a $25,000 investment. Ayub Aziz, who is here in Alaska but unfortunately can't be here today because he had surgery yesterday on his nose, we helped his family escape from Afghanistan with his wife and 4 daughters, because his daughters were getting a lot of pressure to be married off, and he didn't want to sell them. And so we were able to get him visas to Malawi, where he came to then start this fish farm. So for $25,000, we have an Afghan who's never seen a lake before who's going to run a fish farm. But the one great thing about Afghans is they are tenacious, and they are incredibly hard workers, and he figured out how to get online and got some advice, and so we started this hatchery. And the main problem in one of the big problems in Malawi is the lake is being totally overfished. So they're trying to supply farmers with fingerlings for fish ponds. So we're rolling along, and we've got our $25,000 fish farm. There's Ayub and me, and there's some of our fish. And we get contacted by this nonprofit out of San Diego. And they've received a $2 million USAID grant to provide fingerlings to farmers and then help farmers get those fish to market. So they've got $2 million, USAID money, and they're in Malawi. And they spend the first 10 months of their 2-year Grant, setting up their offices and getting their houses and buying their SUVs and hiring their local staff. 10 months getting all sort of sorted out. And then they've realized that they should ask the question, which was, where are we getting these fingerlings? And unfortunately, there were no fingerlings available in the whole country. So now they're in really hot water. They're 10 months into their $2 million grant, and oh, shoot, we forgot to ask where we're going to get these fish. Well, it just so happens that this little fish farm run by an Afghan actually had some fingerlings, and so we ended up basically providing all the fingerlings for this $2 million project over the next year and a half. We sort of saved them a little bit. And so I remember going into a fisheries meeting with this organization, USAID rep, ourselves, and the Malawi National Fisheries. And so the guy from the NGO who was getting the fish from us was basically explaining how they weren't going to make their USAID quotas. You know, they're, and that's kind of, you know, if you don't make your quotas and USAID gets mad at you, then you don't get another $2 million grant for some other project somewhere else. So I'm sitting in this meeting, and he's explaining how they're not going to meet their quotas, and the USAID rep for Malawi basically explains to them how they can fudge their numbers. And I'm like, wow, okay, this is development at work. So I want to talk to you a little bit about another thing we focus on is small business. And so this is an example of a successful business that we gave there were these artists, these painters, that were selling their paintings on the beach, and they were renting a small, dilapidated art gallery. And when we looked at the numbers, it looked like a lot of their profits were being chewed up in the rent. And so I said, well, why don't you guys build your own art studio? And they said, well, we don't have capital. And so we loaned them, Eric and I loaned them, $1,200 to build this art studio. And we put them in touch with Overstock.com to have a market for their paintings. And currently, Tom, the painter, has sold 1,500 paintings online and paid us back in 9 months, the $1,200. That's Tom. He's one of the richest guy in the area right now, and he also has put in a well for his own community. I don't know if you knew that.
Now but tell me. I didn't get any of that money back.
Yeah. Sorry. I used it on poker. all right. So a couple other things that we try to do when we work, a couple other strategies, work strategies, are flexibility and then true sustainability. And why do we say true sustainability? Because I personally feel like the word sustainability has been thrown around so much that it almost doesn't have a meaning anymore. Everybody talks about, oh, we're going to do the sustainable project. But from what I see, that's very rare. And it's really hard to do. And we have a hard time getting to that point. So I'm going to tell you, we started working with through a couple of doctors here, George and Kathy Stewart. We met Ellen Sirleaf, the president of Liberia, and started working with the Liberian government building schools. And one of the areas where we built a school was a place called Bellayela, and it's where there was a prison. A political prison was there since 1917. And there are no roads to Bellayela, and we said, okay, well, that sounds like work for us. Where there's no roads, let's go. And so we decided to build a vocational school in the jungles. It was a 12-hour hike. So obviously getting cement, rebar, other materials into this village where it's 12 hours away by path was pretty difficult. We transported all of our materials down to a village called Riverside, canoed them across, and then moved up to another village where we had a base camp. We had, the only way we could communicate with the people in Baliella was through, they would do radio broadcasts, and then, so we had expected, after sending several messages to the town, we had put out a request for 200 porters to move our supplies. Well, we get to the little base camp, and like 15 people had shown up, and so, you know, we get a few things moving, and I'm with 15 Masons from Monrovia. These are all like city boys who are trained Masons. And so we're sitting there at this village where, because it wasn't market day, they wouldn't sell us any food, and they really wouldn't communicate with us, so we named it No Talking Town, because nobody would talk to us. And so I'm with these 15 Masons, and we're in this village, and we're running out of food, and I have no more clean water. And so I decide to go down back to Riverside, where we had initially brought the stuff. I get to Riverside. They're super friendly people. They give me fish to buy. They climb up this tree and cut down 17 coconuts and open them up and pour them into, I had a backpack that could hold water, and pour them into that backpack. And they said, "We heard that you're building a school up in Baliella. We want to show you our school." And so I said, "Sure, you know." And so I went to see their school, and this was it before it was destroyed, but I'll get to that. So this was their school. And so I said, they said, "Do you think that you could help us at some point? You know, we have so many villages, kids are coming in, we need an additional 3 classrooms, it's just mud, you know, we don't need a lot of help, but if you could help us." And I said, "You know, I'm sorry, I would love to, but I'm currently building in Baliella. We're a small organization, we don't have a lot of money, but thank you for showing me your school." And so they were like, "No problem, thank you." I left. So we get up to Baliella. I'm lucky enough to be able to get helicoptered out, which, because I'm a white guy. And so that night there was a huge storm, that same night that I got helicoptered out, and it destroyed the school. So one of our work strategies is to be flexible with what we do and really focus on where the needs are. And so I found out that the school was destroyed, and I said to one of my Liberian guys, I said, "Well, you know, Daniel, this is your opportunity to really be part of Solace. You're going to go to that village and try to figure out how to build that school for nothing." And he's like, "Oh, great." So anyway, bottom line, and the reason why I'm telling you, this is a school now. But the reason why I'm telling you is just, there was a need there, and instead of, you know, sitting back in, you know, in a boardroom back here making plans of exactly what we're going to do every year, there was a real need there, and the community really made this school happen, because the women carried stones and sand, they provided their own labor for digging the foundation. Ultimately, materials cost for us was $10,000 on this school. So I'm going to talk real quick about true sustainability. You know, true sustainability, to me, there has to be some sort of profits in there. Without profits, how do things continue to run unless they're subsidized? And is it subsidized really sustainable? Maybe if it's with a government school, but one of the projects that we're doing now is in Red Light, which is this market area. There's just incredible amount of slums in Monrovia, densely populated, no sanitation, no running water. Half the city has electricity, so we've decided to build toilet units in these really densely populated areas. The land being donated by the community. And the way that we're making them sustainable is, and this is not the unit, this is in Kenya, but the way that we're making them sustainable is we charge a small amount. So an 8-unit latrine unit, which will serve 400 people a day in a slum that has about 20,000 people, and those 400 people who come and use it every day produces enough profit to pay 3 employees and then $160 for the local community and another $200 for Solace Liberia to pay our staff. And so that's kind of one way of really keeping things moving. You've got, you're paying salaries, the local people are, you know, paying less, like 8 cents to use it, and that's the kind of thinking that instead of just going in and saying, oh my gosh, I feel so bad for these people, let's put in some toilets, which they organizations have done, not having a plan for how they're going to run, what happens is in, you know, 6 months, they're just destroyed. I mean, you know, they just get run over. So another thing we try to focus on is combining green methods in our construction and infrastructure work. We had a great guy that worked with us in Kenya who had shown really good promise, and so we have started using different types of green building, using ferro cement, rainwater harvesting, soil stabilized blocks. One of the biggest problems, one of the biggest reasons for deforestation in Africa is because of burn bricks, the clay-fired burn bricks. And so what we've done is we've started producing SSB, which are soil stabilized blocks that aren't, you don't need wood to fire them. So we've been doing that in Kenya and Malawi for quite a long time, probably, you know, almost 5 years. And this Kenyan who's shown great promise, who's actually an orphan, in his 20s, we said, Bonzi, we're going to give you an opportunity to take all of these skills that you have, all the work you've done in Kenya, and bring it to Guatemala. And so here's this Kenyan who's never left Kenya, now being thrown into this small village in Guatemala where no one speaks English. He's the only black guy, and they're just like, wah. And so, but it's good for him, you know. He's got the skills, and it just, it took him a little time to get his feet on the ground, about a month. But what's really cool is he went and in 9 months built an orphanage. We have an orphanage in Malacatan, Guatemala. And he used all of these really interesting green techniques that the locals had never seen. This is an earth bag house that we're building. But what's really cool is that while Bonzi was in Guatemala, he met some other organizations that taught him some different green building methods. And they taught him how to build with plastic bottles. And so Bonzi has now started his own program back in Nairobi. He left Guatemala this summer and went back to Nairobi and is now teaching in inner city schools. The kids collect all the plastic bottles and they teach them how to build with the plastic bottles, and then they're doing all this infrastructure work in inner city schools in Nairobi. So it was a really great exchange of ideas. He picked up some new stuff and was able to bring it back home. Lastly, I think this is my last point. When we first started fundraising, I noticed that it wasn't easy to get donations, and you know, somebody might write you a $50 check, but that's a lot of talking and to get a lot of $50 checks. And so I noticed that in our first fundraiser in Anchorage that people really liked carpets and that stuff, handicrafts from Afghanistan, and so we started bringing carpets and handicrafts back from Afghanistan. And then after a few months, I just sort of thought, wait a second, we should be thinking about who is making this stuff so that there's a double benefit, so that we're raising money on one end and helping the women on back at home, back in Afghanistan or wherever the stuff's being made. So I wish Ayub was here, but Ayub and his wife and daughters helped us start Cottage Industry, and actually Michelle Winston, who designed all that jewelry over there. We started Cottage Industry with 200 women and producing all of these scarves. And a lot of these women, you know, didn't have husbands. They were widows, had no source of income. And so we were able to produce all of these different handicrafts from Afghanistan. And we toured around, that's Ayub and Michelle. We toured around the U.S. Some of you guys bought some of our scarves and stuff years ago. and sold this stuff. Well, after giving speeches and driving around in an SUV with a trailer for 4 years, we got pretty burnt out. And so we finally got a little bit of corporate funding, and I was able to go into the field and actually spend most of my time working in the field. That 4 years of the break from the fundraising trail, I'm revived again, and I'm enjoying being out and talking to people and sort of doing the sharing with about what we're doing and what we've learned, because I have learned so much over the last few years. I mean, it started out very simple, just building girls' schools, and it's been amazing. Sort of my own capacity for understanding this stuff has really grown a lot over the last 8 years. So the reason why we've decided to start up the cottage industry again is because it is a win-win situation. If we can sell goods that help support women in, now it's in Nepal, and we're going to still be getting stuff from Afghanistan, then we raise funds to have projects and to do projects, and we also help employ these women. So that's my spiel. That's what I gotta say. We'll probably do a question and answer. I was gonna have Marcus sort of wrap up. And yeah, we'll maybe do a question and answer after this. Marcus, you wanna wrap up?
Sure. Hi, good evening. Afternoon, I mean. My name is Marcus Stanfill. I'm the communications director for Solace International. I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and met Nate here. And we, knew each other over the years. I knew he disappeared in 2002 to go to someplace like Afghanistan, but I didn't expect him to call me when he got back and say, hey, let's throw a little fundraiser, which we did on the tennis courts of the Alaska Club way back in October of 2002. I think he gave me 2 weeks' notice to get that thing started. Somehow, miraculously, we pulled it off, and we've basically been pulling, rabbits out of our hats since then. There's that conundrum of you have to have money to actually achieve goals to then get money, and we were right in the middle of that. But as our track record has improved over the years, we've actually been able to step back a little bit and take a look at how we've been operating and say what's worked, what hasn't worked. In some cases our failures have been our most valuable tools to understand how this stuff actually can get done. And that's really our goal, is to take the funds that we're getting and actually put them to work in the field. Get past these things like buying SUVs for your staff, giving everybody a CellSat phone, and trying to figure everything out from, 6,000 miles away in a boardroom. What is actually happening on the ground is where you need to have that decision making. And so using some of the tools that we talked about today, in terms of being flexible, working smart, starting small, using local buy-in, buying local, trying to get community leaders involved, all these things, they're just logic that actually applies in the field, to talking to people on the ground, to getting them excited. And that is probably one of our most important things, is in terms of actually getting that buy-in. So starting in 2002, our one goal was to build 2 schools in Afghanistan. This is what we're looking at for next year. We have a small staff, but we are using that staff efficiently, and we're trying to get those people into the ground in the areas that we need them to work, get our budgets, all kind of straightened out, and get the work done. And that's how we actually achieve what we're doing, is by working smart. And this is kind of encapsulates it. With a $3 million budget, that's what we've achieved in the last 8 years. I would like to brag and say that's actually kind of remarkable. and we would, at this point, we'd kind of like to start shouting about it and try to set that bar for other organizations to try to follow and say, this is actually achievable. You need to start really thinking about how you're how you're working. We see a lot of problems with federal grants, with foundation grants. It's extremely structured in the way they're, and it's important to be able to report and show how you've used those monies. But if your actual field operations are then compromised by not being flexible enough to change the motivation and change the ideas of what you're doing in the field, then you may have actually kind of bypassed what you're trying to achieve. Recently, we've seen in the headlines riots that are happening in Haiti. Haiti has been, over the years, considered probably one of the most heavily aided countries in terms of dollars per person in the world. And yet, the question is really going out, have we over-aided that country? Have we replaced the government with international aid groups? Have we not actually helped the people but created a situation of dependence? And those are really hard questions. We try not to give but try to get people to participate in what they're doing and what they want. We call it, in some cases, a low-hanging fruit. You know, if you're willing to help us help you, then you're going to have that kind of idea about where it all goes and have a local buy-in. So I think that might be the... Yes, that is the wrap-up. So in one of our fundraising projects, of course, we do have some jewelry from Nepal that we were producing here. We have some of the scarves from Afghanistan, and we have an event this week at Tarabella Coffee on Sunday from 6 to 9. We have some flyers out in the back, and we would love to, you know, get you to support what we're doing. But I'd like to turn it back to Nate and open it up to questions. I'm sure you have a few. Thanks very much.
Is on. Yes, it is. Thank you so much for coming back to Anchorage and talking to us again about what you've been doing and what you've accomplished. It's absolutely spectacular. My question is, how do you pick the countries and the projects you're going to be working in? I noticed that you're in many places around the world, and I would think that would lead to inefficiencies.
You know,
but I'm sure you have criteria, and I'm just wondering.
Yeah, and that's a great question. Almost all of our projects are somehow related to a personal contact or an organization that's doing something really good on the ground. So, for example, Tom and Ruth Nicewander introduced us to Malawi Children's Village, and we went and really liked what they were doing down there, and so we built the school. Tim Thomas introduced us to Young Generation Center Orphanage in Kisumu, Kenya. And so we went and loved what they were doing there and built a school. We're starting a project in Zimbabwe because there's a couple that we know from Malawi, a white couple that have returned because the community has asked them in Zimbabwe to return to their 2,000-acre ranch. And they're totally supported by the community, and they do a feeding program for 300 orphans. Well, they're getting the money from churches here in the U.S., and that's not sustainable. So what we want to do is go in, and Ayub is going to look at putting in a fish farm for them so that they can grow the fish to sustain the orphanage program. We're looking at doing some permaculture with them to just get them more efficient on food security and what they grow. So, you know, Liberia was also another set of Anchorage doctors, George and Kathy Stewart. So it's really been personal connections, and that really, at least that's one level of sort of vetting in the vetting process that you've got projects already somewhat vetted. And generally, I'm really careful. I don't want to. It takes time to get to know a community, and you've really got to be on the ground for quite a while or have someone else on the ground for quite a while to really understand the dynamics. I mean, the one example that I gave you, the two villages, No Talking Town, where they wouldn't talk to us, and the other village were, you know, 2 kilometers apart, and they were worlds apart. They could have been different countries. So it's really important to know that community that you're working in. And then sometimes it still doesn't work out. So you just, you know, you never know. Yes.
Nate, how do you handle communications? You need to motivate the women to carry rocks and rebar and cement. How do you handle that communication in the various areas that you've gone to?
I let my local guys do it. I stay out of it. You know, in Afghanistan, we've had communities help build schools. and you know, just the local guys go talking to the community. And one of the, it's a, depending on the country, some countries are, like Nepal is amazing. The villages there, they just jump right in because I think they're not so saturated by aid. When you get into countries that have been saturated by NGOs, sometimes they won't help you because they think that you're stealing their salary, because they know that NGOs are rich. So they're thinking, well, are they wanting us to help build the school because they want to pocket our salaries? And so it just depends. It depends on how oversaturated it's been.
Two questions. One, a point of clarification. The $3 million, is that the total spend over the 8 years, or is that your annual budget?
That's what we've spent over 8 years.
And the second thing is, when I last heard you, I think about 18 months ago, at the fundraiser down on 6th,
yes.
You were talking a lot about Kenya, and I didn't see Kenya in the list of the projects.
It blew up. It's been a tough year. The project blew up, and I'm totally willing to talk about it, and if you want to ask questions, but yeah, the project blew up in our face. So some of the important.
Now, as communication director, I would say we had some challenges.
But I'm sure you learned.
Yeah, well, it was pretty painful. But that happens, so.
Nate, can you tell us a little bit about what the progress is with the schools in northern Afghanistan that you built years ago?
Yeah, I actually asked Ayub to have his brother go visit the schools that we built, and they're all still running. And they're all running primarily because of the location, more than anything. You know, northern Afghanistan's a lot more liberal, and they've kind of resisted, they always resisted the Taliban and were, you know, more open to women's education. You know, if you guys do want to talk a little bit, maybe after one, if anyone wants to stay, I definitely have some things to talk about with Afghanistan. And I do wish Ayub was here because he's got some really interesting theories about kind of where it's heading and you know, what's happening on the ground. I don't know if you want me to get into that now or just wait till later. Yes. You want me to get into that now? Yes. Okay. Well, you know, I was in Afghanistan with Ayub when it was determined that we were going to attack Iraq. And I remember saying to Ayub, we need to get a TV because I've got to see this because I don't think it's going to be so good. And so we bought a $200 little dish, and we sat drinking tea and watching the America attack Iraq. And so that was, when was that? Do you guys remember when that was?
March 2003.
So probably another year in Afghanistan was decent, maybe another 18 months. But people started asking questions of, they just didn't understand sort of why we had not finished the job with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And so basically, and I wish Ayub could tell because it's way better hearing it from an Afghan than some white guy. But basically, when we came in and kicked the Taliban out of Afghanistan, 90% of the population was thrilled. The problem is we didn't get rid of the Taliban. We just chased them to the Pakistani border. And we kept funding the Pakistani military, and the Pakistani military has been funding the Taliban. So the Taliban in Pakistan is being funded by us. And so as we fund them, they grow stronger. And as Ayub puts it, it's like watering the roots of a tree, which is the root is of the problem is in Pakistan, and you're watering it. You're giving money, which is the water and fertilizer. The branches are going out, which are the young men who are brainwashed in the madrasas. They're running across the border and getting killed by our guys. But those are just little branches. The root is getting stronger and stronger. And so IU believes that it's too late, that ultimately we waited too long, and there's really no way that we can do anything at this point because they're too entrenched in Pakistan, and they're going to continue to come over. And right now, the Afghan population is confused. They don't know what America is anymore. They don't know what the development. They're just confused. So ultimately, I guess Ayub's opinions and thoughts on are that we need to probably go, and then there's going to be, and then the Afghans need to fight amongst themselves, and then see how it plays out after that. But it's not a good situation. That's kind of uplifting, right? Wonderful. Yeah, I'm here to bring Christmas cheer.
I'm going to go back to Kenya, more Christmas cheer. No, but just to, I wanted to take this opportunity to, and this is not a question, it's just an opportunity to say thanks to Solace. What they did in Kenya was quite remarkable, and all of these stories, this philosophy that Nate has talked about, the quick decisions, the flexibility, really came to play in Kenya. And I'll just describe that briefly. We had been living in Kenya, in Kisumu, involved in this orphanage. There was a crumbled down building that they used for a school. And we were umbrellaed under the Alaska Community Foundation. And we approached them and said, you know, we really think that we need to raise money to build a school. And they said, oh, you know, why don't you get in touch with Nate York? And by the way, he's on his way to Sudan in about a month, but he's coming through Nairobi. And so we got an email contact, and Nate said, sure, I'll, you know, spend a couple of days in Kisumu on my way to Sudan. And I don't know if I picked him up at the airport, took him to the orphanage, and I think probably by the next day, Nate said, yes, we're going to do this. And not only did they build a school, but it just went in so many different wonderful directions. And I really do appreciate what they did there. The whole, what has happened since, I don't want to get into, but I really do want to appreciate and thank Nate. Thanks. And Solace for what they did.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for coming today. I had a couple of questions. First of all, how do you measure the success of a project? Does someone come back there after you build a school or whatever infrastructure it is that you build in a community? Does somebody come back there after a certain period of time to check on how it's going? And and then I have a not so related question with that also. The other thing is, how do you deal with training people to get to know how to use the projects that you build in their community? Because if you're having projects where you have to hike 12 hours and, you know, canoe, whatever, you have to be flown away. Once you leave that community and something goes wrong, you know, and somebody who has probably like the technical expertise to fix something later on will have to do that kind of travel to there, but that's not really very
right.
So do you train locals for that?
Yeah,
so
those are two questions. Both are good questions. It totally depends on what type of project it is. So for example, in Indonesia, we built three schools. Two of them were government schools that we just been wiped out from the tsunami. So we just came in, did infrastructure, handed over the community. They applied for to get federal government status. Within 2 years, they had teachers from the government, good to go. Government curriculum, you know. Same with Afghanistan. Built schools, worked with the Ministry of Education. They came in, brought teachers, et cetera, et cetera. So those are easy. That's just a matter of coordinating with the government. Other projects, you know, like, for example, maybe a poultry project or a permaculture project or just different. It's really that I measure success by if it's profitable and if it's going to run once we're gone. So that's where we measure success, is that it keeps on rolling without us there. And that doesn't always happen, but we have a lot of experience, and so I think we're able to see which things might work and which things are definitely not going to work. And so, you know, that's how I measure success. Does that answer your question on that? Okay. And then the second question was, what do we do in places like Bellyella? How do we train the community? Bellyella, in particular, is a government school. So we came in and built the vocational, it's an agricultural vocational school. We brought a agricultural expert from Kenya who spent a year there training locals. And then the government has come in and are providing teachers and all those things. Now, in the case of Bellyella, the government has not provided what they said they were going to provide. So they haven't provided as many teachers as they promised, as the president promised. So I'm kind of in a little bit of a dilemma right now where, ironically, the Riverside School is running more efficiently, which cost us almost nothing, and the larger school in Bellyella is having some problems. So in that case, even though I was assured by the Liberian government and the two senators that I worked with and the president that they were going to provide all these, you know, teachers and curriculum by such and such date, that hasn't happened. So what's that mean? Well, I got to go back and figure out how we can help them and get some additional teachers in there, and maybe we have to pay some teachers for a couple years. It's every situation is different. So it's absolutely problem solving all the time. That's, you know, there's no cookie cutter situation. I guess we're done. Yeah?
Nate has agreed to stay a little bit longer and answer more questions. We realize that we've gone the hour. So for those who have to go back to work or back to your things, you can take this opportunity to stop by his stand there on your way out. But Nate will stay for another 15 minutes and answer more questions for those who want to stay. So this could be your transition time.